Welcome to Saturday, July 11th. Today we are looking at how American influence is warping international sports, the latest pivot in the AI arms race, and why the book world is having a moment. It is a busy morning, so let's get right into it. The United States' role as host for the upcoming 2026 World Cup has sparked a governance crisis at FIFA. The administration reportedly pressured the organization to overturn a red card suspension for a U.S. player. FIFA President Gianni Infantino, pronounced Johnny Infantino, remains in power, despite the controversy. Here's the thing. This wasn't just a refereeing dispute. It signaled that host nations can exert direct political leverage to bypass disciplinary rules. While the U.S. lost to Belgium in a previous tournament context is often cited as a benchmark for performance, this current situation exposes a system that is essentially immune to outside accountability. Most of FIFA's 208 member nations rely on development grants, which keeps them tethered to the current leadership. It's a closed loop where fiscal survival trumps democratic oversight. FIFA is also currently eyeing an expansion to 64 teams. They're chasing revenue, but they're likely turning the sport into a volume-driven entertainment product at the expense of athlete health. Moving to domestic politics, we are seeing a shift in the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA. Candidates are increasingly favoring systemic restructuring over incremental reform. A key example is New York candidate Darielisa Avila Chevalier, pronounced D-A-R-E-A-L-I-S-A Avila Chevalier. These campaigns often lean into populist rhetoric about local grievances while avoiding technical discussions about the economic outcomes of their proposals. The strategy here is a masterclass in obfuscation. By refusing to provide specific legislative roadmaps, these candidates avoid being held accountable for the historical precedents of their ideology. It shifts the burden entirely onto the voter to research the consequences of their proposals. Some critics argue these candidates are operating as a parasite within the Democratic Party, using its ballot access and institutional legitimacy to push the platform toward extremes. It's a risky game that could alienate moderate voters and fracture the party from within. Meanwhile, in the UK, Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson, pronounced Philippson, is pushing an interventionist agenda based on the idea of education as freedom. She's focused on early years support, childcare, and breakfast clubs, a marked departure from the previous government's autonomous school management model. Phillipson is leaning into the friction. When opposition leader Kemi Badenoch, pronounced Kemi Badenoke, called her agenda spiteful class warfare, Phillipson took it as a compliment. But there is a disconnect here. The Labour government admits it has failed to build a cohesive, optimistic narrative, allowing symbolic issues like the winter fuel allowance to overshadow substantive wins like the Employment Rights Act. The lesson is that, if you don't define your own brand of freedom, your opponents will define it for you as a public nuisance. Back in the States, there is a growing argument that we are in the middle of a war on the young. The economic data is fairly stark. Since 1974, the S&P 500 has grown by 4,000%, while real median income from labor has only increased by 40%. We have essentially built an economy that prioritizes asset ownership over the value of work. Federal per capita spending on seniors is now 8 times higher than spending on children. We are witnessing institutional stagnation, where incumbent re-election rates exceed 90%, and elite universities keep their enrollment numbers artificially low to maintain prestige. The result is a generation of 30-year-olds who are opting out of traditional milestones like having children. If you want to know why the social contract feels broken, look at the math. We are financing the prosperity of the old on the credit of the young. In the Maine Senate race, Graham Platner has withdrawn, which is just the latest example of a broken political vetting process. Parties have stopped acting like gatekeepers and started acting like reactive networks of consultants. They prioritize a candidate's narrative and populist appeal over basic due diligence. This leads to a specific kind of volatility. When the activist base demands an outsider candidate, the establishment often caves, only to face a total collapse when the candidate's history catches up with them. We're seeing a similar dynamic in the push to abolish property taxes. It's being sold as an affordability measure, but it's actually regressive. It encourages seniors to stay in their homes, which constrains housing supply and keeps younger families out of the market. It's identity-based pandering that prioritizes the wealthiest demographic at the expense of future growth. Finally, the state of the media. Legacy news organizations are increasingly being bought by billionaires, and it's changing the product. When an outlet becomes a bargaining chip in a billionaire's political or regulatory strategy, editorial independence is the first thing to go. Look at CBS News under David Ellison. Falling ratings, internal turmoil, and the decline of programs like 60 Minutes. As quality journalism moves behind paywalls, we are drifting toward a two-tiered society. The wealthy get the accountability-focused news, and everyone else gets low-quality, algorithm-driven content. The gatekeeping role of traditional journalism is breaking down, and while that allows for new voices, it also makes it nearly impossible to maintain a shared reality. On the Democratic side of the aisle, there is a growing push to abandon procedural purity. Progressive commentator Brian Tyler Cohen argues that Democrats are losing because they play by rules that their opponents ignore. The party treats the filibuster as an immovable barrier for climate change while watching the opposition bypass norms for judicial appointments. It's a losing strategy. The argument is that you can't protect democratic norms by letting them be dismantled while you stand on the sidelines clutching a rulebook. The survival of the party likely depends on them moving from the defense of abstract norms to the delivery of actual economic results. We are also seeing a transparency crisis regarding the health of our elected officials. When senior lawmakers disappear from public view without explanation, it creates an information vacuum. Cynicism fills that space immediately. We lack a formal, independent mechanism to assess the fitness of our representatives, so the responsibility falls on the individuals themselves. Predictably, they rarely choose to step aside. When you add that to the way political scandals are now handled, where tribal loyalty protects the transgressor regardless of the behavior, you get a public that is completely alienated from the system. We've stopped using political parties as gatekeepers of character. We've turned them into protective shields. It's a structural liability that compounds every single year, and it's turning our governance into a desperate game of survival. That kind of institutional rot is hard to watch. Speaking of systems trying to force a new reality, the AI industry is making its own desperate plays for control. The AI industry just hit a wall, or a pivot, depending on how you look at the balance sheet. OpenAI has been integrating chat, browsing, file management, and automation into a single, integrated app. The goal is to move users away from manual prompting and toward agent orchestration. You aren't just telling a chatbot to write a summary anymore. You are managing a system that navigates your local files, your browser, and your internal software to finish long-running tasks. It's a push to turn the AI from a novelty into a permanent fixture of your desktop. This transition is happening because the market has officially cooled on raw intelligence benchmarks. The race is now about cost efficiency and how well these models play with your existing software stack. OpenAI's mid-tier model is reportedly outperforming competitors on coding tasks while costing significantly less. That is a hell of a gap to close. If you're a company running thousands of API calls, that difference isn't just math. It's the difference between a project getting the green light or getting cut. Anthropic is already feeling the squeeze. They recently reset their weekly usage limits, which is usually a sign that they are either seeing customer churn or bracing for a mass exodus of enterprise clients. The competition is getting crowded too. Meta is back in the mix with new, lower-priced models. They are pricing them at roughly one quarter of what their competitors charge. That kind of aggressive pricing is turning AI infrastructure into a weapon. It's forcing a price war that threatens to compress margins for shops like OpenAI and Anthropic. If proprietary models become cheap commodities, the old debate about open source versus closed source might just evaporate. You won't choose one over the other. You'll just use the cheapest, fastest model for the job. Infrastructure isn't slowing down, though. Meta is building a 1-gigawatt data center in Canada and pushing its own internal silicon chips. They are clearly trying to cut out the middleman, specifically NVIDIA, to control their own destiny. As these models get cheaper and faster, the real bottleneck for companies is no longer the cost of the tokens. It's the complexity of plugging these agents into a corporate environment without breaking everything or leaking sensitive data. If you're an engineer, the job description is changing in real time. We are seeing a move toward what people are calling specification enrichment. Instead of letting an LLM just spit out code, teams are now using formal loops to check that code against architectural artifacts like design docs or flowcharts. You use judge agents to evaluate the output of other agents. If the quality score, measured by something like Cohen's Kappa, pronounced Cohen's K-A-P-P-A, drops below a certain threshold, the system flags a human. It's about building a structural gate for quality rather than hoping the AI gets it right on the first try, which, honestly, is how software should have been built from day one. Anyway, there is a broader, messier reality to all this. The gap between what these tools can do and what our institutions are prepared for is growing. Look at the recent cheating scandal at Brown University. They are still relying on take-home tests, and the students are, predictably, using AI to do the heavy lifting. The grades don't reflect what the students know anymore. They reflect who has the best access to the model. It's a classic case of institutional lag. The tech has moved into a phase of functional, task-oriented utility, but the way we assess competence is still stuck in the era of the Blue Book exam. The takeaway is that the era of AI hype is mostly behind us. We are in the grind now. Success isn't defined by who has the smartest model in a vacuum. It is defined by who can provide the most reliable, cost-effective harness to do actual work. If your organization or your school isn't figuring out how to integrate these agents into the actual workflow, you're just paying to watch everyone else get faster. The push for efficiency is clearly the theme of the week. Even in the world of horse racing, the old ways of doing business are getting shredded by data. Horse racing is currently grappling with a logistical mess at the track. Weather-related disruptions are forcing organizers to move race times on the fly, which keeps schedules in a constant state of flux. Colonial Downs recently moved its final race up specifically to dodge lightning, a move that happens more often than the industry cares to admit. When tracks prioritize getting the full card and oversticking to a set post time, they create a headache for anyone trying to handicap the field. The friction is also heating up between regional tracks. Prairie Meadows in Iowa and Horseshoe Indianapolis in Indiana are essentially fighting over the same group of elite horses. By stacking their stakes calendars, they've forced top trainers like Bob Baffert and Ruddy Brissett, pronounced Ruddy Brissett, to pick a lane. This splits the talent pool, which honestly makes both races look a little thinner. It's a classic case of tracks trying to muscle into each other's territory, leaving bettors to guess which trainer is actually going to show up. If you're looking for where the real action is, stop staring at the morning line odds. High-profile trainers like Brad Cox are notorious for cross-centering horses in multiple graded stakes, which causes field sizes and odds to shift right up until post time. The real edge seems to be in tracking trainer-jockey partnerships. When a horse moves to a new barn, like in the recent case of Little Jamie moving to Safi Joseph Jr., a pronounced Safi Joseph, that new stable effect is often a much better predictor of a big performance than any raw speed figure. There's also a growing shift toward automated handicapping. Some players suggest that instead of grinding out manual calculations, bettors should be using data-driven software to synthesize pace figures. Their strategy focuses on skinnying tickets, betting fewer horses in early race sequences to create leverage for the final legs. They point out that favorites who are closers in turf sprints win only 12% of the time, which is a hell of a thing to ignore if you're betting based on name recognition. Ultimately, the sport is evolving into a centralized, high-stakes game. You either get comfortable with the data, or you get run over by the people who are. It's not just about picking the fastest horse anymore. It's about managing the logistics and knowing when a trainer is playing games with their entries. It seems like nobody is allowed to just play the game anymore. Everything has to be managed, regulated, and optimized, which is exactly what is happening with college athletes right now. The College Sports Commission is tightening the screws on name, image, and likeness deals. They have rejected millions of dollars in proposed deals, accounting for a significant portion of all submissions. They are using a system to centralize approvals, processing dozens of deals a day. This is a clear pivot toward institutional compliance over the Wild West spending we saw early on. Schools are now required to use this system for any deal over a certain threshold, effectively killing off those loophole-based agreements. It is a hell of a thing to watch the industry suddenly prioritize auditready agreements after years of unchecked growth. Infrastructure is getting the same treatment. The NFL is looking at modular, transportable venues for its new flag football league. They're taking a page from the ICC Men T20 World Cup, which used temporary cricket setups. It's all about lowering capital risk. Why build a permanent stadium when you can just pack up and move where the demand is? Manchester United is going the other way, pushing a massive, mixed-use district around a new stadium, but the goal is the same: turning dead space into a year-round revenue engine. Meanwhile, the media landscape is getting complicated. FIFA is now forcing bidders for upcoming cycles to bundle English and Spanish rights together. That's a direct shot at traditional broadcasters like Fox. If they can't prove they can reach both audiences, they're out. This opens the door for companies like Netflix or Disney to swoop in with data-driven, multi-language streaming models. Sports media is becoming a game of volume. The bet is that more tournament teams and more regular season games will keep people watching, but there's a real risk of dilution. Look at the WNBA. Viewership numbers are stable, but because games are spread across so many different outlets, it looks like ratings are dropping. It's an optics problem caused by a fractured footprint, not a lack of interest. We're also seeing a shift toward technological optimization in how athletes are built. In the UFC, performance institutes are used to manage metabolism and prevent weight-cutting issues. It's not just about winning. It's about risk management and keeping the product on the screen. But this brings a weird erosion of the sport itself. When you focus on technical engineering over raw human ability, you eventually force regulators to step in and draw lines. Finally, the NBA is proving that modern front office success is less about scouting raw talent and more about navigating the collective bargaining agreement. We are seeing multi-team trades designed specifically to bypass hard cap constraints and preserve flexibility. Organizations are realizing that having an inflexible, high-cost veteran contract is a liability. The teams winning right now are the ones that treat financial and regulatory agility as a core competency. It's a dry, calculated way to run a league, but it's the only way to survive the current system. When you turn student athletics into a massive financial engine, this is the bureaucracy you get. It is a messy transition that mirrors what is happening in the publishing industry. The book Regime Change has seen significant sales in its first week. Authors Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan say the success reflects a public desire for grounded reporting on an increasingly opaque executive branch. They describe the current administration as a highly disciplined group of loyalists. This is a shift from the leak-prone environment of the first Trump term. The authors report that verifying information has become significantly more difficult. They spent substantial time discarding material that could not be cross-verified to their standards. Because the inner circle is smaller and ideologically aligned, internal whistleblowing has largely vanished. The authors argue the burden of accountability now rests entirely on external verification. They also address the critique that revelations should be published in real time. They contend that the book format is a necessary technology for mapping long-term policy arcs. They point to the escalation of tensions with Iran as an example of a story that fragments under the lens of daily news. The reality of this reporting model is grim. The authors describe a schedule of 16-hour days, 7 days a week. They note that this work relies on the massive institutional infrastructure of the New York Times asterisk. It is a high-burnout boutique model that is not actually scalable, which, honestly, is a hell of a thing to admit about the state of high-impact journalism. We are looking at a market where the demand for truth is rising. At the same time, the human cost to provide that truth is becoming unsustainable. It is a shitty situation for the industry, but it is the reality of trying to cover a government that has effectively shuttered its doors. Moving to the industry side, the 2025 Emmy nominations are out. They reveal a stagnant creative landscape defined by a lack of new breakout hits. The pool of nominees relies heavily on established, late-stage series. The era of annual, reliable releases in television is effectively over. We are seeing longer gaps between seasons, which creates a down year for drama. Even shows with a limited cultural footprint are securing major nominations, simply because there is a lack of deep competition. The Television Academy is leaning on sentimental farewells for long-running hits to keep people interested. Gene Smart and Hacks are currently being discussed as strong contenders for the September ceremony. Meanwhile, the potential merger between Paramount and Skydance is hitting walls, while Warner Brothers Discovery continues to navigate its own standalone strategy. The British government intends to intervene in media consolidation generally. A coalition of United States states may follow suit. This adds up to a level of antitrust scrutiny that is, frankly, becoming the new standard. The deal carries severe financial penalties for delays. This creates a binary outcome for the parties involved. It is either a rapid close, or it turns into a compounding financial crisis. Finally, the fight over intellectual property and artificial intelligence is intensifying. Meta has introduced an opt-out policy for AI image training. Talent agencies like Creative Artists Agency are pushing back. They argue that using a creator's likeness without explicit, proactive consent is unsustainable. This is the classic ask for forgiveness, not permission strategy. The second-order implication here is a widening divide in the industry. High-end talent with sophisticated legal teams can effectively opt out. The majority of creators remain vulnerable to unauthorized exploitation. Eventually, tech platforms will likely be forced to pivot to an opt-in model. This will happen under pressure from powerful talent collectives. It is a predictable cycle, but one that leaves the average creator as collateral damage in the meantime. Television is suffering from creative exhaustion. The business side is colliding with regulatory and legal safeguards that are finally starting to show some teeth. Both segments are at an inflection point. It is not just a slow news day, it looks like a structural reset. The appetite for these kinds of deep dives suggests we are all looking for answers in a chaotic environment. That same need for stability is showing up in how we treat our own lives. Personal stability is currently being framed through the lens of foundational health, capacity building, and long-term financial endurance. Recent analysis suggests that individual success is often hollow if it ignores physical and relational health. people are increasingly discussing the dangers of ramping up production and consumption while burning through internal resources. The result is a fragile life that crumbles at the first sign of systemic shock. The fix isn't more optimization. It's prioritizing sleep, nervous system regulation, and local community ties. Unglamorous work that actually builds the buffer needed when things go sideways. There is also a push to rethink how we build personal capacity. The argument is that your internal capacity is the vessel and your opportunities are the light. If you try to force high-intensity success, like wealth or fame, without first building the vessel, you end up with emotional instability or a total collapse. It's a warning against skipping the process. Committing to a path, even if it turns out to be wrong, builds more wisdom than the stagnation of indecision. Finally, financial resilience is being linked to a barbell personality. You need to be relentlessly optimistic about the long-term future while maintaining a deep, protective pessimism about immediate risks. Historically, the U.S. economy has endured 34 recessions and 9 major wars, yet still trended upward. The lesson here is that volatility is the price of admission. To survive it, you should prioritize timeless skills like clear communication over passing trends and manage social envy through radical transparency. If you show people the unglamorous, stressful reality of your work, you strip away the veneer that triggers jealousy. Look, we're obsessed with growth metrics that don't actually keep us upright. Building a life that lasts doesn't look like a highlight reel. It looks like boring, consistent maintenance. We have to stop pretending that grinding yourself into the dirt is a strategy for success. That is the news for today. I will be back tomorrow morning to see what else has managed to break. Have a decent Saturday.